Hello, my name is Matt Sandy. I'm a program manager at Microsoft on the DirectX team, and I'd like to talk to you today about direct compute memory patterns. For this presentation, I'm going to go over a summary of the direct compute memory model, and then I'll go over the basic application execution flow. And I'd like to examine some common input-output scenarios for both buffers and textures, including some example code. And I'll end with how you can use shared memory to improve your application's performance. One of the features unique to Direct Compute is the memory model that it uses. Unlike other compute APIs, Direct Compute partitions memory into what are called resource objects. Now, there are two main types of resources in Direct Compute. The first of these resources is called a buffer, which allows you to store arbitrary data formats, such as user-defined structures. The second is textures, which are useful for media formats, such as images, video frames, or any data that is pixel-like. In Direct Compute, resources are accessed using views. The point of having a resource view is that it conveys usage intent, and this can permit some hardware optimizations to occur. For example, if you have a buffer that you know you will only ever be reading from, you can create a read-only view of this resource. This enables some optimizations. Likewise, for the case of textures, it also gives you access to the fixed function sampling and translation hardware that is available on the GPU. So for example, if you have a texture and you create two different views of it that have different pixel formats, then when you cast between these, the hardware conversion happens automatically, and you get this conversion for free in your application. Now, it's important to note that when you access data from within your compute shaders, you must access this data using these views, not using the resources directly. For resource objects, the most common views you will have are the shader resource view and the unordered access view. The first of these, also called an SRV, provides read-only access to a resource. The second, a UAV, provides read-write access. As you can see in the graphic below, you can create both of these views on the same resource object and use them on compute shaders. Before I dive into memory input-output, I'd like to go over some of the basic executions of a direct compute application. So the first thing you want to do in a direct compute application is to call createDevice. What createDevice does is it initializes the GPU and prepares it to run compute shaders or any of the other pipeline stages of the rendering pipeline. When you call createDevice, it gives you two handles to the GPU. The first of these, called the device, represents the high-level state of the GPU. This represents things such as what compute shaders exist, what buffers exist, and what views exist on the GPU. The second handle you get to the GPU is called the context. This represents more of the low-level transient state of the GPU, such as what shaders are bound to the pipeline, what views are bound to what shaders, and also allows you to actually dispatch and send down work to the GPU. So once you've called createDevice, the first thing you want to do is to call createComputeShader. And what this does is it takes our GPU code, as you can see here, our compute shader. What this does is it compiles it through the driver compiler and sends it down to the GPU. As you can see in this code, we have an input buffer and an output buffer, so we will need to create buffers for each of these. So we call createBuffer again on the device, once for each buffer. After we've created our buffers, we need to create our views. As you can see, the first buffer is going to be read-only by the fact that it's a structured buffer, and the second one will need to be read-write, as it is a read-write structured buffer. So the first thing we do is to call create shader resource view on the device, which will create an SRV on the first buffer. Likewise, we'll call create unordered access view on the second buffer. Once we have all of our high-level state set up on the device, we need to start binding stuff to the pipeline. So the first thing we want to do is on the context, call csSetShader. What this does is it takes our compute shader that we've downloaded to the GPU and it binds it to the pipeline. What this does is it says, when we send work down to the GPU, we want it to run on this compute shader. But we haven't yet provided access to the data from that compute shader. So the first thing we need to do is, again on the context, call csSetShaderResources. This allows us to bind our SRV to the compute shader. Likewise, to bind our UAV, we call, again on the context, csSetUnordered access views. Now at this point in our application, all of our high-level state is set up, all of our low-level state is set up, and we're ready to finally dispatch work to the GPU. So now, on the context, we call dispatch, which takes all the input buffer elements, square roots them, as you can see in the shader code, and stores them to the output buffer. So when dispatch runs, it takes all of these elements, runs them simultaneously through the SIMD cores, and outputs them to the output buffer. Now that you know how the memory model and execution model works in direct compute, we can examine some of the common input-output scenarios you'll typically deal with. The first of these is reading-writing of structured data, as you would find in, for example, array multiplication. The second is reading and writing of unordered data, such as in a particle system. The third is loading data from an image, as you would use for image analysis. The fourth is writing data to an image, such as for data visualization. And the fifth is in-place read, modify, write of image data, such as for our use in a lightweight image post-processing algorithm. The most straightforward way to do input-output in direct compute is to use what's called structured or indexed I.O. Indexed I.O. operates exactly like arrays, and you can even use atomic operators on them to create thread safety. Although if you find yourself using these atomic operators frequently, it's probably best to take a step back and rethink your algorithm. It's important to consider something called write contention for read-write data. So multiple writes to the same buffer location will produce undefined results because threads are not guaranteed to execute in any particular order. This code here shows the runtime code used to create both a buffer resource and a read-write view of it. Be sure to create the buffer with the unordered access bind flag set. This will enable you to create an unordered access view of the flag, of the buffer. In this code here, we show the code to create an unordered access view. However, creating a shader resource view is similar in practice. Once you have the buffers and views created, the resource in the compute shader can be indexed just as if it were an array. As you can see here, we declare an input buffer, myInput, by declaring it as a structured buffer of type float. Likewise, for our read-write buffer, we declare a read-write structured buffer, also of type float. And as you can see here in the code, we can index into these just as if they were standard C++ arrays. In order to do this with any logic, however, we need to understand what thread we're actually in within the compute shader. Now, there are four ways to do this in direct compute. The first of these is to use what's called the group ID. This value represents the dispatch unique group ID of a particular thread group. So in this case, as you can see here, we're dispatching a set of 4x2x1 groups. So in this case, our group ID will range in value from 000 to 310. The second way to do indexed I.O. is to use what's called the dispatch thread ID. This value is a unique value for every single thread in a particular dispatch, and it takes into account both the thread group size and the dispatch size. So in this case, our dispatch thread ID will range in value from 000 to 127.310. The third way to do indexed I.O. is to use what's called the group thread ID. The group thread ID is similar to the dispatch thread ID, only every single group will have a thread that has the same group thread ID. So group thread IDs are unique only to thread groups. In this case, group thread ID will range in value from 000 to 3115.0. The last way to do indexed I.O. in direct compute is to use what's called the group index. The group index is similar to the group thread ID, only this value has been flattened. So instead of ranging as a 3D value, it is simply a scalar value, one value for each thread in a thread group. So in this case, our group index will range in value from 0 to 511. Indexed I.O. can be simple and intuitive, but it is also somewhat inflexible. Additionally, it often places unnecessary ordering restrictions on your algorithm, which can hinder performance. Append and consume buffers can solve both of these problems. In order to create one, you need only create your UAV with the append flag set, as you can see here. Other than that, the creation flags are very similar to indexed I.O. As you can see here, the declaration for the inputs and outputs are similar to structured I.O., except for they are declared with consume structured buffer and append structured buffer for input and output, respectively. On a consume structured buffer, we can use the consume method to consume a value from this object in the same way that you would pop a value off the end of a stack. Likewise, we can append a value to the output buffer, which will be the same as effectively pushing a value back onto a stack. Using this technique, we can operate on all the elements of an input buffer and store results to an output buffer, but not impose the requirement that the input and output indices will correspond to each other. This was the case with indexed.io. I'd like to show you a demo now that makes use of the append and consume technique to create a particle system. So this demo makes use of append and consume buffers to simulate a particle system. And this system can use append and consume buffers because in this sample, the particles are not interacting with each other. Instead, they are only interacting with the predefined forces in the environment, which in this case is charged particles in a gravitational and electromagnetic field. As I mentioned before, compute shaders can not only operate on buffers, but on textures and media formats as well. Like the pixel shader, compute shaders have access to hardware-accelerated filtering and sampling hardware as well. This is important because today, the hardware still represents a significant fraction of the die area on the GPU. So if you can make use of this fixed function and sampling hardware in your application, you can get a huge performance win. In order to make use of this hardware, we need to create a texture with one of the standard pixel formats. Be sure to create your texture with the bind shader resource flag set, which will enable us to read from it using an SRV. As you can see here, in our declaration of our shader resource view, we set its dimension to texture2D to indicate that it describes a view of a 2D texture. In this compute shader code example, we'll be loading the input data from a texture, doing some math on it, and writing the data to an output texture, or to an output buffer. As you can see here, our input texture we declare with texture2D, and our output buffer we declare with read-write structured buffer. In order to get data from this texture, we can call the load intrinsic on it, with the dispatch thread ID as our argument. This is convenient because in our texture is two-dimensional, in which case the dispatch thread ID, each thread corresponds to a single pixel in the image. The Z dimension, always zero in this case, corresponds to the MIP level or quality level of the texture. In this shader code, we're simply taking the value of this color, calculating the magnitude of each component, and storing this magnitude out to our output buffer using indexed.io. In addition to reading it from an image, we can also do random access writes to an image as well. Again, hardware pixel format conversion is supported. However, unlike the pixel shader, blending and compositing operations are not. As always, be sure to avoid write contention on destinations. In order to write to a texture, you need to create an unordered access view of the texture. In order to do this, you also must set the bind unordered access flag on your texture creation. In this example code, we're taking an input buffer, a structured buffer of float 2s, and generating a color for each element, which will allow us to visualize the data. Similar to read-write structured buffers, an output texture will be declared as a read-write texture 2D. As you can see in this code, we're defining two colors, red and blue, using the first value of our input buffer to interpolate between red and blue, and then using the second value to scale the intensity of this color, and then finally writing the output color to our texture at this location. Note that the output texture writing format is similar to indexed.io, except for that the argument is a two-dimensional vector. The reason that this is two dimensions as opposed to three in the reading sample is because our unordered access view explicitly declared which MIP or quality level we will be writing to. In addition to read-only and write-only for images, you can also do read-modify-write. This enables efficient in-place image operations, such as for red-eye removal. There are some restrictions on this technique, however. For example, the shader code must handle format conversion itself, as hardware conversion is not supported in this scenario. Additionally, the base texture format must be one of the 32-bit typeless formats, and the unordered access view must be created with the 32-bit unsigned integer format. This means that we will need to unpack and pack our pixel data manually from within the shader. We can do unpacking using basic bitwise arithmetic, and likewise, packing using the same inverse arithmetic. In this example, we're doing a very simple color channel modification. In this case, if there is a significantly large red value of the pixel, we're simply going to replace it with the average of the green and blue channels. Now that you know more about device memory I/O, I'd like to go into the other form of memory available in compute shaders, and that is group shared memory. Device memory is relatively high latency, and accesses should typically be avoided whenever possible. What group shared memory does is it acts like a programmable cache, which allows these device memory loads to be avoided in some cases. In all the previous examples, every thread required a single data element, so every single load was necessary. But often this will not be the case, and many threads will read from the same buffer location. In order to use shared memory, first we need to declare a group shared array. In this case, we're declaring group shared float temp of size 256, which will give us one float value for every thread in each thread group. In order to make use of this, first what we can do is we can do index.io on an input buffer, my input, and load this value into our temporary group shared array. Now before we can use these values, we need to do a sync operation to avoid read after write hazards. We do this by calling group memory barrier with group sync. What this does is it ensures that all threads have reached this point and completed their I/O operations before going past this barrier. Once all threads pass this barrier, however, we can index into the group shared memory just as we did with device memory. In this case, what this algorithm is doing, it's taking a one-dimensional input vector, taking the average of all the buffer locations up to 8 left and 8 right of the current thread location, and storing the average value out to the output buffer. So in this case, 16 of the 17 required loads for each thread are taken from group shared memory, which significantly reduces the bandwidth requirements for this algorithm. In summary, you now have learned what the direct compute memory model looks like. You've learned about the basic flow of a direct compute application. You've also learned how to do indexed I/O for array-like operations, as well as append and consume I/O for unordered operations. You've also learned how to do read-only, write-only, and read-write operations on images, and how to use shared memory to reduce device memory accesses and improve your application's performance. Thank you for your time, and I hope you have found this lecture to be helpful.